Coming up next, we speak with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a New York University professor and fascism expert. We'll also speak with a journalist who looked back at Madison Square Garden in an Oscar-nominated film, 1939, a Nazi rally held in the middle of New York City. Stay with us.
You take what they give you and you keep it inside. Every spark of friendship and love will die without a home. Hear the soldier groan, glad it alone. Take me out of here. Don't want to fight, don't want to die. Just want to hear you cry. Who's gonna throw the very first stone?
Intervention by Arcade Fire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Vice President Kamala Harris makes her closing arguments to voters tonight at the Ellipse near the White House, where Donald Trump gave his speech on January 6, 2021, just before his supporters rioted at the Capitol. Trump made his closing argument Sunday at Madison Square Garden. As he did so, local Democratic socialists protested nearby at Bryant Park. For more on Trump's closing arguments and the rise of the authoritarian right, we're joined by Ruth Ben-Ghiat, expert on fascism and authoritarianism. She's the author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, and a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. She also publishes the newsletter Lucid, on threats to democracy. Professor, welcome back to Democracy Now! In these lead up to this final week of the election, if you can talk about the comments of President Trump, everything from arresting his enemies to the enemy within, and what this echoes for you.
Yeah. So, you know, fascism started almost 100 years ago with in both Italy and Germany with a core of combatants from World War One who brought the war home and turned their wrath and their force and their violence on liberals, on leftists, on progressive priests, on anybody who did not was not in their leader cults. And so when Donald Trump talks about America being an occupied country that he's going to liberate, this is the language also of Francisco Franco. This is the language of fascism and violence. And, you know, when we think about all the dehumanizing rhetoric and the explicit references to Hitler's Germany, you know, Trump doesn't want people comparing him to Hitler, even sued CNN for $475 million, claiming they were comparing him to Hitler. But he himself has, his campaign has explicitly made these parallels, even releasing a campaign ad that talked about him creating a, quote, unified Reich, and, of course, calling people vermin. And I want to say something about the use of profanity and the crudeness of all of these remarks at the Madison Square Garden rally, which, of course, was the site of the American Nazi rally. Because we think about authoritarianism as imposing controls on people and silencing people, and it certainly does that. But it also is designed, from fascism forward, to make people become their worst selves, to give them permission to be as violent and unrestrained as possible. And so deregulation, just as, you know, the Project 2025 wants to deregulate environmental protections and food safety things following what happened during the Trump presidency. There's also a deregulation of inhibitions, of morals, and so that you will be not less bothered when the violence starts. You will turn the other cheek or you will participate in it. And this kind of profanity, you know, at women, the misogyny, anti-Black statements, the calling Latinos garbage. It's not only a tradition of dehumanization that starts with fascism and goes through authoritarian movements up to our day. It's also designed to make people feel, the foot soldiers of MAGA, that there are no restraints, there are no controls, and everything will be accepted as long as it is in the service of targeting the enemy within.
I wanted to go to two clips of Donald Trump, and these have become quite familiar. He called for the National Guard or U.S. military to be deployed on U.S. soil to target what he called radical left lunatics. Trump made the call, at least this particular one, he said it repeatedly during an interview on Fox News.
I think the bigger problem are the people from within. We have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics. And I think they're and it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military, because they can't let that happen.
And this is Donald Trump speaking in Aurora, Colorado, earlier this month.
It's the enemy from within, all the scum that we have to deal with that hate our country. That's a bigger enemy than China and Russia.
And of course, we know what John Kelly said, his former longest lasting chief of staff, the general who called him the definition of a fascist. Your response, Professor Benguia.
So, you know, retired military officers, especially generals, don't speak out unless they feel there's a real need to do so. And the fact we're seeing General Kelly, General Milley, former Defense Secretary Esper speak out and use the F word, calling Trump a fascist, means that, you know, they are highly concerned about the, a possible misuse of the military. Because, again, this goes back when Trump talks about scum and perhaps needing to use the military against them. This echoes, you know, Francisco Franco and the whole discourse of the subhuman, which was integral to fascism. But there's also a geopolitical dimension. It's very important because if you're Putin or Xi or North Korea, and you know, have your expansionist aspirations, the power and professionalism of the U.S. military is a huge problem. The global reach of the U.S. military is a huge problem. So here comes Donald Trump, who's the latest partner of Putin. There's been Gerhard Schroeder, Silvio Berlusconi. Now we have Trump, who wants to give the U.S. military a new role, concentrating them on domestic repression, withdrawing from NATO, with calling troops back from abroad. Mm-hmm. And so we have to think about who benefits geopolitically from this rerouting of the military. I'm not saying the military would go along with this, but this is what Trump is saying by when he declares repeatedly, and as does J.D. Vance, that the bigger problem, you know, Russia and China are not the biggest problem. It's the enemy within. So this refocusing of military and armed force on American people benefits Putin, benefits Xi, benefits any autocrat who has expansionist ambitions.
That's right. Good.
I want to bring into this discussion Marshall Curry. Marshall Curry went to the Madison Square Garden event. But he also did an Oscar-nominated film. That film was called A Night at the Garden, about the 1939 Nazi rally at Madison Square Garden. This is a clip.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow Americans, American patriots, sure, I do not come before you tonight as a complete stranger. You all have heard of me. through the Jewish-controlled press, as a creature with horns, a cloven hoof, and a long tail. We, with American ideals, demand that our government shall be returned to the American people who founded it.
If you ask what we are actively fighting for under our charter, first, a social, just, white, Gentile-ruled United States. Second, Gentile-controlled labor union, free from Jewish Moscow-directed domination.
A Night at the Garden. That was an excerpt not of Nazi Germany, but of a Nazi rally at Madison Square Garden in 1939 from the Academy Award-nominated short film directed by Marshall Curry. That voice, explain what we just saw and listened to, and the person, the protester who came up and was beaten up.
Sure. So in 1939, there was a rally in Madison Square Garden where 20,000 New Yorkers gathered to celebrate the rise of Nazism. And when I first saw that footage, I was completely shocked to see the American flag and George Washington and, you know, hear people singing the Star Spangled Banner and saying the Pledge of Allegiance and then offering the stiff-armed salute and cheering white supremacy. So the man who was speaking was named Fritz Kuhn. He was the head of the German-American Bund, which had camps all around the country, had quite a big following and some significant power. The protester who runs out on stage and is beaten up was a man named Isidore Greenbaum, who was a Jewish plumber's assistant who just went to the rally that night to find out what was going on and was shocked and appalled by what he saw.
And you went to Madison Square Garden Sunday?
I did. So I made this film 7 years ago with out of archival material that we'd sort of found in the National Archive and UCLA's archive and Grinberg Archive. And that was, you know, 7 years ago at the beginning of Trump's administration. I saw some similarities between some of the demagoguery that was happening on stage in 1939 and what Trump was doing at his rallies. And so, but I'd never actually seen a Trump rally personally. And so when I heard that he was going to be at Madison Square Garden, I thought I needed to go and see it for myself.
And Marshall Curry, as you mentioned, your surprise, many Americans are not aware of how extensive the fascist, the Nazi movement was in the U.S. Back in those days. Could you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, when I grew up, I always learned in school that America took on the fascists and we fought the Nazis and defeated them. And we did. And that's a great, you know, point of pride for our country. But we were not entirely united. As today, there were people in our midst who were anti-Semites, who were anti-immigrant. And I think the thing that struck me the most about seeing that footage was the way that the demagogues in 1939 used the same tactics that we see today. You know, they use this kind of dark humor. They wrap, you know, their ideology and the symbols of patriotism, and they go after immigrants and the press and minority religions, and they do it to distract people from the fact that they really want to cut taxes for rich people and take away health care and do policies that people wouldn't support.
And I'd like to ask Ruth Ben-Ghiat, this Madison Square rally has happened numerous times in U.S. history. People forget that in 1968, when George Wallace, the white supremacist governor, was running for president, he held a rally at Madison Square Garden in October of 1968, and it was filled as well with segregationists right here in New York City. And in fact, the police were picking up people in the streets, anyone who was trying to protest the Wallace rally. I know because I was a young college student at the time, trying to get down to Madison Square Garden, was picked up by the police blocks away from Madison Square Garden, and we were held in vans until after the rally was over, hundreds of people. The reality is that filling Madison Square Garden is really not that hard for a political movement. You're talking about less than a metropolitan area of 20 million people. Being able to get 20,000 zealots in an arena is basically two-tenths of 1% of the population.
Yes, and the other thing is that this rally, all the different strains of it, playing Dixie, this Trump rally, Trump has always provided a big tent from the very beginning, 2015-16, for every possible kind of racist and extremist in America. He addressed himself to Southern racists, he addressed himself to Proud Boys, to neo-Nazis, famously, at the Charlottesville rally. Every type of person with a grievance, and then enlarged that with espousing great replacement theory. And, of course, in partnership with Fox, with the GOP elite, et cetera. And so all of this was represented at this rally, together with people from the fields of business, like the businessman Grant Cardone, who said, we have to slaughter these people, referring to people who aren't supporting Trump. And you had people from the world of entertainment and from sports. And so Madison Square Garden, a seat of spectacles and sports spectacles, entertainment spectacles, political spectacles, was the perfect place, actually, for MAGA to show how many people are fitting into its big tent of racism and extremism.
Ruth Benguia, I want to thank you for being with us, expert on fascism and authoritarianism, wrote the book Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Her newsletter is called Lucid on Threats to Democracy. And we want to thank Marshall Curry, director of the Oscar-nominated short film A Night at the Garden, about the Nazi rally at Madison Square Garden in 1939. When we come back, as billionaire Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos defends his decision to block the paper from endorsing Kamala Harris, we'll speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning Post reporter David Huffman, who's resigned from the Post editorial board in protest, and with Los Angeles Times editorials editor Mariel Garza. She resigned after the LA Times billionaire owner also blocked the board's endorsement of Harris. Back in 20 seconds.
Than zero. Oh yeah. You tried your best with me, I know. I couldn't face you with my darkest truth of all. Oh, cause I can't get it out of my head. No, I can't shake this feeling that crawls in my bed. I try to hide it, but I know you know me. I try to fight it, but I'd rather be free. Oh, 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 yeah. Can we meet in the middle?
Less than zero by the weekend. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Los Angeles Times and The Washington Post are facing mounting backlash after the paper's publishers announced no presidential endorsements would be made this year. The LA Times is owned by billionaire Patrick Soon-Shiong, and The Washington Post is owned by Amazon's Jeff Bezos. NPR's reporting more than 200,000 people have canceled their Washington Post subscriptions and counting. A number of journalists have also resigned, including the editorials editor at The Los Angeles Times, Mariel Garza, who wrote, how could we spend 8 years railing against Trump and the danger his leadership poses to the country and then fail to endorse the perfectly decent Democrat challenger who we previously endorsed for the U.S. Senate? unquote. Veteran journalists Robert Greene and Karen Klein have also resigned from the L.A. Times editorial board. At The Washington Post, David Huffman and Molly Roberts both resigned on Monday from the Post editorial board. Michelle Norris also resigned as a Washington Post columnist, and Robert Kagan resigned as editor-at-large. David Huffman, who just won a Pulitzer Prize for his series Annals of Autocracy, wrote, quote, "I believe we face a very real threat of autocracy and the candidacy of Donald Trump. I find it untenable and unconscionable that we've lost our voice at this perilous moment." David Huffman joins us now, along with former Los Angeles Times editorials editors Mariel Garza. David Huffman, let's begin with you. Explain why you left the Washington Post editorial board. Oh, and at the same time, congratulations on your Pulitzer Prize.
Thank you very much. I worked for 12 years writing editorials in which I said over and over again, we cannot be silent in the face of dictatorship, not anywhere. And I wrote about dissidents who were imprisoned for speaking out, and I felt that I couldn't write another editorial decrying silence if we were going to be silent in the face of Trump's autocracy. And I feel it very, very strongly that the campaign has exposed his intention to be an autocrat.
And David Huffman, is there any precedent for the publisher of the Washington Post overruling their own editorial board?
Yeah, there's lots of precedent. It's entirely within the right of the publisher and the owner to do this. Previous owners have often told the editorial board what to say because we are the voice of the institution and its owner. So there's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong here is the timing. If they had made this decision early in the year and announced as a principle they don't want to issue endorsements, nobody would have even blinked. A lot of papers don't. People have rightly questioned whether they actually have any impact. What matters here was we are right on the doorstep of the most consequential election in our lifetimes. To pull the plug on the endorsement, to go silent against Trump days before the election, that to me was just unconscionable.
And Mario Garza, could you talk about the situation at the LA Times and your reaction when you heard of the owner's decision?
Certainly. It was a long conversation over the course of many weeks. We presented our proposal to endorse Kamala Harris. And of course, there was no question that we had endorsed her. We spent 9 years talking about the dangers of Trump, called him unfit in 5 million ways. And Kamala Harris is somebody that we know. She's a California elected official. We've had a lot of conversations with her. We've seen her career evolved. We were gonna endorse her, and there was no indication that we were going to suddenly shift from to a neutral position, certainly not within a few weeks or months of the election. At first, we didn't get a clear answer. Sounds like it's the same situation that happened at The Washington Post. Until we pressed for one, we presented an outline with these are the points we're going to make, and an argument for why not only was it important for us, an editorial board whose mission is to speak truth to power, to stand up to tyranny, our readers expect it. We're a very liberal paper. There is no question what the editorial board believes, that Donald Trump should not be president ever.
Mario,
it was perplexing. It was mystifying. It was
Mariel, I wanted to get your response to the daughter of the L.A. Times owner. On Saturday, Los Angeles Times owner Patrick Soon-Shiong's daughter, Nika Soon-Shiong, posted a message online suggesting that her father's decision was linked to Kamala Harris's support for Israel's war in Gaza. Nika wrote, quote, "Our family made the joint decision not to endorse a presidential candidate. This was the first and only time I've been involved in the process. As a citizen of a country openly financing genocide and as a family that experienced South African apartheid, the endorsement was an opportunity to repudiate justifications for the widespread targeting of journalists and ongoing war on children, she wrote. Her father, Patrick Soon-Shiong, later disputed her claims, saying she has no role at the Los Angeles Times. Mariel Garza, your response.
I don't really know what to say, because if that was the case, it was never communicated to us. I do not know what goes on in the conversation in the Soon-Shiong household. I know that she does not participate in deliberations of the editorial board, as far as I know. I've never spoken to her. We all know how she feels about Gaza, because she's a prolific tweeter. So I really can't say. And this is part of the bigger problem, is we were never given a reason for why we were being silent. If there was a reason, say it was Israel, we could have explained that to readers. Instead, we remained silent. And this is not a time in American history where anybody can remain silent or neutral.
And David Hoffman, this whole issue has been raised by some critics of Jeff Bezos, that his company has a lot of business with the U.S. government, and whether that had any impact on Bezos' decision. I'm wondering your thoughts.
I can't be inside his mind. His company does have big business, and he's acknowledged it's a complicating factor in his ownership. But I can't really understand why he made this decision, and I don't think it's been very well explained. His explanation published today was that he wants sort of more civic quiet, and he thought an endorsement would add to the sense of anxiety and the poisonous atmosphere. But I disagree with that. I think, like in the LA Times, I think readers have come to expect us to be a voice of reason, and they've looked to endorsements at least for some clarity. So, frankly, I also feel that we're still lacking an explanation.
The subtitle, the slogan of The Washington Post, of course, democracy dies in darkness. It's being mocked all over social media. One person wrote, "Hello, darkness, my old friend." David Hoffman, your response to that. But also, you won the Pulitzer Prize for your series, Annals of Autocracy. And you talk about digital billionaires as well and what this means. How does this fit into your investigations?
You know, I would hope everybody would understand and acknowledge that we've done a lot of good for democracy and human rights. I've had governments react sharply to a single editorial. When we call them out for imprisoning dissidents, it matters that we are very widely read. And that's another reason why I feel this was a big mistake, because we actually were on a path for decades of championing democracy and human rights as an institution. And, you know, I have to tell you, I've wrote a book in Russia about oligarchs. I understand how difficult it is when you have a lively and independent group of journalists, and ownership really matters. And, you know, we're not just another widget company. This is actually a group of very, very deep thinking and oftentimes very aggressive people that have a desire to change the world. That's the kind of journalism that the Washington Post has sponsored and engaged in. In 2023, we published a series of editorials that took a look deep inside how China, Russia, Burma, other places, how these autocracies function. One of the findings was that many of these dictatorships are using technology to clamp down on dissent, even things as tiny as a single tweet. Young people, young college students are being thrown in prison in Cuba, in Belarus, in Vietnam. And I documented these to show how this technology actually isn't becoming a force for freedom, but it's being turned on its head by dictatorship.
We have to leave it there. David Hoffman, Washington Post reporter, stepped down from the Post editorial board when they refused to endorse presidential candidate Mariel Garza, L.A. Times editorials editor who just resigned. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! War, Peace, and the Presidency. On Tuesday, November 5th, I'll be joined by Juan Gonzalez, Nermeen Sheikh, and guests from around the country for a live election night special. I hope you'll tune in at democracynow.org from 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time for our one-of-a-kind reporting and analysis on this critical election.